This is Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive, continuing my oral history interview with Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer. Today's date is the 5th of April, 2004. I am on the campus of Texas Tech in the Special Collections Building, and Colonel Kammermeyer is in Washington State. Good morning.
Good morning.
I wonder if we could pick up a couple of threads from our last session. First of all, can you tell me a little bit about your work at the 352nd EVAC in Oakland?
Okay, now we have skipped a little.
Sure, okay, go ahead and fill in the missing bit then if you like.
No, I mean, if you want to go right to the 357th, that's fine.
No, I know that you were in Washington State at the VA before moving down to San Francisco.
Yeah, but I think right now we're sort of combining two different things.
True. Mm-hmm.
Because in 1972, the policy had just changed regarding women being allowed to serve in the military with dependents.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so I was, that's when we discussed a little bit about why going into the reserves.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
why you had selected that as opposed to returning to active service.
Exactly.
Yes. Uh-huh.
At the same time, I mean, the two things were happening simultaneously. One was that I went back into the reserves, and that was up here in Washington State and at the 50th General Hospital. Again, a paper hospital until time comes for mobilization.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mobilized under a different number to go to Iraq, the first war.
Greta, do you know that number?
6250th.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And because by that time the 50th had been deactivated and united with the 6250th, and so many of the staff that I had worked with at the 50th ended up going to the 6250th and then to Iraq.
Okay, and 6250 had pre-existed then? It was already organized? And
yes, it was. Okay. It was another large hospital unit out of Tacoma, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined the 50th, and at the same time I was working at the VA hospital. So that was in my civilian capacity.
Right.
And then for the 50th, where I ended up getting promoted to major after I had for a while.
What year was your promotion?
Oh,
okay.
I can pull it out.
That's all right. That's okay. It was sometime then in the mid-70s. Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I there I worked on, let's see, where did I work? I was one of the coordinators of the clinical facilities and sort of oversaw the running of the clinical experience for people. And then I stayed with the 50th until I ended up going through a divorce and ultimately leaving the greater Seattle area and going down to San Francisco, where I became, in the VA hospital, I became the clinical specialist for neuro-oncology and was there for 5 years. And that's when there was a brief visit at another facility, I can probably for about a year, and
mm-hmm.
then transferred to the 352nd,
okay.
Where ultimately, I became chief nurse over the next 5 years.
Was neuro-oncology a new addition to your background?
Yes. Neuro-oncology, the VA down there was needing a neuro-oncologist.
Mm-hmm.
My specialty was a neuro,
right.
but not a subspecialty in oncology, neuro-oncology. And it took a while to get into, but I was specifically hired for that task,
mm-hmm.
and spent the next 5 years doing that, which was just absolutely the most extraordinary job I'd ever had.
Now you,
other than Vietnam.
Why do you say that, Gretel?
Well, because there was the specialty itself was one of dealing with people who had brain tumors and whose life expectancy was limited, to say the least. But my job was to try to get them on the right medical protocol to save their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really assumed really more of a role as a resident rather than as a nurse. And probably because of my personality and also the fact that I had a neuro background, being able to then present cases to the tumor board and to get them mm-hmm. placed on neuro protocols, I actually ended up being sort of that all-around person of presenting them to tumor board, putting them on a brain tumor protocol, giving them the chemotherapy, admitting them to the hospital, and in most cases seeing them through their death and working with their families on dealing with the loss of all of that. So most people, I think I considered myself sort of the angel of death, if you will, that because anybody that ultimately was working with me as a client ended up dying.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this ominous nature to it, but also at the same time this tremendous sense of responsibility of, you know, could I help this person get on the right protocol to save their life?
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this, and I think part of my Vietnam experience was looking for the best out of a worst situation. And where before, you know, I had said that you had to start life when you were at your worst.
Yes.
And to be able to then appreciate all of the little nuances of improvement here with putting people on chemo protocol, it was somewhat analogous in terms of having to deal with the person and trying to find that right medication combination.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess hoping more than anything else. And I think I had probably two patients in the over 100 that I dealt with that sort of beat the odds.
Were these patients at any time included in research trials?
Oh, yeah,
well?
all of this was
sure.
Research.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that's why they were presented at tumor board.
Mm-hmm.
That's why putting them on protocol. So they were all research subjects because
mm-hmm.
To not go on a research protocol would automatically, you know, mean death. And so I was following them very, very closely throughout all of that.
Were there several different drug therapies being tried simultaneously, or were you working sort of one set at a time?
No, every patient had a different potential of going on a different protocol because part of it was based on how what treatments they had had before they came to us. Part of it was based on the pathology of the tumor itself, whether or not it was a glioblastoma multiforme, which is the most virulent of all of the tumors, or whether or not it was an astrocytoma. So depending upon the pathology, it determined what options there were in terms of approved protocols.
And were you? Is it fair to say that you were sort of the point person between the research team and the patient?
Yes, I mean I was their VA, research
mm-hmm.
person as well as clinical person because there was really nobody else that was working at the VA hospital that essentially saw the patient
mm-hmm.
because I did all of the follow-up also, which is,
right.
you know, part of the extended clinical practice that I was doing. I was working with in other capacities with the neurosurgeons at the VA hospital, but in terms of the tumor follow-up, they would do the surgery, and then the patient would essentially be mined.
Greta, what is speaking now about the EVAC hospital that you were working with? Can you give the characteristics of an MUST unit?
A MUST unit is a mobile unit surgical team. It's one where, in those days, it was one where you had a team or a hospital that, in the reserves, was sort of packed up and ready to go, and that you had then an entirely mobile hospital, so that you would take that, say that you were activated or you were going on a field hospital, all of your equipment would be put onto a truck and be trucked out to some medical facility, and you would erect the hospital and do your, if you were doing exercises, it would be to set up the wards, set up the administration, set up the mess hall, set up the latrines, and then have MUST patients go through. And so part of it was practicing until you were blue in the face, so that you really would be able to get this hospital up and going within a very short period of time if you were activated to go to a combat zone.
And I take it that that you did go on numerous military exercises then?
Yeah, we did. At least for 2 weeks every year we would go to various places. And usually every other weekend or so there was some field exercise of some kind, although the hospital or the clinical staff, we would have working in clinical facilities, so that, you know, it's one thing to be a nurse where you are working in the clinical area all the time, but many of the medics, only on drill weekends were they having an opportunity to do actual clinical experience. So you need to try to provide some opportunity for them to do that, or else if you're mobilized, then they're learning how to do temperature, pulses, and respirations on their first casualty, and that's not
acceptable.
A good thing.
Right. Were your the requirements of your position fairly static through the 1980s as you moved from the San Francisco area back up to Washington?
Well, when I moved from that position, when I moved back to Seattle, it was trying to find. I used to commute back and forth for my drill weekend down to California, probably for about a year or so.
Okay, so you stayed affiliated with the 352nd?
Yes, okay. Because it's not like you can find the ideal job just by moving from place to place,
sure.
And because by this time I was a colonel.
Okay.
And to find a job as a colonel meant that you would be going in as an outsider to perhaps vie for a chief nurse position somewhere.
Right.
And most facilities didn't want to bring in a new person because they already had, you know, homegrown expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was looking for a home, the Washington State National Guard did not have a chief nurse yet. There were only two other nurses in the National Guard up here, and the state surgeon wanted to build up the medical assets, and so when I actually there were five nurses. When I heard that they were looking for a chief nurse, I applied for the position, and then ended up getting it, and again sort of creating a job that didn't exist, and then ultimately there were some changes that took place in the structure of things, and we ended up being given a hospital. Now, you know, I'd say this sort of that somebody brought you a present and said, here's your hospital to play with.
Mm-hmm.
What they gave was the guard a piece of paper that said, you're now authorized to recruit and create the staff and structure for a hospital that would be activated at the call of the governor or at the call of the president. And then my job became recruiting to bring people in while other staff people in the hospital were to make sure that we were getting supplies and that, you know, the training exercises began and those sorts of things. So recruiting became the major focus so that we would have a staff as such. And
mm-hmm.
and over the years, the configuration of the hospital changed also, so that we ultimately were to have a hospital that was extremely mobile, was part of the new medical configuration, which essentially meant that every nurse, every medical person except for the chaplain would end up not only being familiar with weapons, but being qualified.
And so at some point here you had to go through weapons qualifications?
Yes. That had happened, actually.
Okay.
Began in probably the early 70s,
mm-hmm.
that there was a change, and I think part of the outgrowth was as hospitals were being hit in Vietnam, because when I went back into the reserves, we were still in Vietnam in 1972.
Right.
And there was this gradual shift to even women who were not involved in regular or non-hospital situations would be would need to be qualified. So the Army became integrated. They did away with the Women's Army Corps,
mm-hmm.
and so everybody had not only the same uniforms, but ended up having the same types of training. And that's where we began shooting rifles at first, and then for field grade officers going to 45s.
Mm-hmm.
And we got good enough to get, you know, our little medals to put on our uniforms.
Sure.
And stuff. I mean, it's a big deal. How do you have more of your biography visible?
Yes. Okay. I see what you're saying with
yeah.
the medals.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the distinctions or perhaps lack of distinctions between serving as an officer in the Army Reserve and serving in the National Guard?
I think the main thing that, well, many people, including me, did not realize that these were really very comparable positions, and
mm-hmm.
that they're, the difference between the Army Reserves, for example, is that is an part of the military organization that is the bastard child of active duty services. So that you go right, and you can complete your obligation in the reserves, and for
mm-hmm.
that matter, in the Guard also. But if you don't want to go and be subject, now this is old.
right.
Yeah. If you don't want to be subject to the call-up, if you want to have an opportunity to have a civilian life and have a family and
mm-hmm.
just move on and still be part of the military, you could go into the reserves. But if you're in the reserves, you are not subject to responding to state emergencies. And for many of us who were part of the reserves, the frustration was that here we had equipment, we had the know-how, and when Mount St. Helens blew and other floods and fires, we were not able to assist, which seemed an absolute waste of resources to us. And it's because of how the structure was set up, that the reserves are at the call of the president.
Right.
the other hat of the military is really part of the early militia,
mm-hmm.
where the state has a responsibility to protect the state. And to do that, the governor essentially is the commander-in-chief of a military militia, and that is the National Guard. And all of the states have a National Guard, which are at the beck and call of the governors, still get funding from the federal government, but are at the beck and call of the governors, so that if there's a riot at the prison, if there is a state disaster, if there is a rule and unruliness, he can call up the National Guard for the good of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so it used to be very different. Now, because I think they made some mistakes, they being the military planners, after Vietnam, they made some mistakes in how they configured things, and then after Iraq, they've made some mistakes in how they've configured and said, you know, we will have X type of units in the National Guard, we will have X type of units in the reserves, and then we'll have X type on active duty. But what they haven't looked at is the broad picture in terms of what the states might need and what happens when there is a call-up or the military is activated and you don't have the cadre of support either that you readily need, because it takes time to mobilize reserve forces, both to get them ready at the same level pitch that active duty people are, and also because they have to disengage from what they're involved with here at home.
Yes.
So I think that what you will see after the Iraq II war is complete, that there will be a new reconfiguration of who is where.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that they did after Iraq I, you know, that hospital that I was given,
yes,
they took it away. out of that Iraq I, there had been 24 hospitals that had been assigned throughout the United States that were National Guard hospitals. And those hospitals were moved from the National Guard to the reserves. And what that means is that there is not a single governor that has a hospital unit that he can activate in case of an emergency.
Now, that was at the time, or that's...
No, now.
Yeah, now.
Now. That was
wow.
A change from Iraq I to
mm-hmm.
Iraq II, thinking that would be a way of better utilizing resources. But I think it's been a bad mistake for the state. And but to have medical units in the reserve forces has some real drawbacks also, because when those units are activated, it pulls out the hospital personnel and civilian hospitals so that they become short-staffed.
Mm-hmm.
But that is going to happen in any unit, like a military police unit where you have state patrol and local patrol or local police that are part of the military police unit. When those are activated, that shorts everybody else.
Right, in an area, in an industry that's already short.
Absolutely. And also that at the way currently Reserve and National Guard units are what appears to be indiscriminately called up and repeatedly called up to do police actions that, you know, many of us think, well, that's what we're paying the full-time personnel
sure.
to do.
Sure.
And yet they're activating and really... I think misutilizing the intent of the Reserves and National Guard, and I think there's going to probably be a huge discussion as well as attrition that takes place as people come home and decide, you know, I can't risk, I don't want to risk not only my life, but I don't want to risk being called up and losing my profession
mm-hmm.
Just at a beck and call.
And And it's your view, if I'm right, that that these reconfigurations that have flown down through the past two decades really are part of the continuing search for the right strategy in the wake of Vietnam?
I think so. But I think that there are so many political reasons for some of these moves that take place, and much of it having to do with how many generals can you have,
mm-hmm.
and because it has to have a certain size personnel
mm-hmm.
Within a unit to be a general, and that's, you know, everybody's dream is to be a general and to have a star.
Grant, I want to ask you, looking back over your career with the VA specifically, the time period that you worked with the VA was one in which Vietnam veterans did not always get along with the Veterans Administration. And I wonder if, from your perspective, you can just comment on the relationship between veterans and the VA broadly.
Well, I know that there was a lot of unhappiness on multiple levels.
Mm-hmm.
And having seen the after effects of Agent Orange in Vietnam and then the Gulf syndrome of folks coming back from Vietnam, in many cases, both sort of combinations of people coming back with undifferentiated symptoms and things were
mm-hmm.
really rejected as, you know, just seeking that they were malingering, that they were trying to get something that they did not deserve.
Mm-hmm.
And so they became victimized still again by individuals who said, well, you know, this is all in your head. You're just wanting to get something out of the military or to get out of the military. And it was extremely annoying to me as a Vietnam veteran, for example, to have to hear the abuse, if you will, of veterans who had served their country and then who were coming, having believed themselves to be promised to have VA care,
mm-hmm.
and then individuals saying that, no, it's all in your head, there's nothing wrong with you, and then years later coming to find out that indeed there was a bad side effect from Agent Orange, for example. And from my perspective, when I saw then veterans coming back from Iraq and being exposed to the same thing, you know, I would frequently get into arguments with people that, you know, here you've got somebody high functioning beforehand,
mm-hmm.
going off to war and then becoming incapacitated at home, and they're malingering.
Right.
I mean, and just because we can't put a finger on what the etiology is does not mean that it doesn't exist. It means rather that we don't have a clue, but there's a problem, and we better find out what it is. And so I always try to treat my patients as though it were me. You know, the thing, you know, it's all about me. Well, you know, if you imagine yourself in their shoes,
yeah.
how would you want to be treated? What sort of gatekeeper and role model and mentor would you want to meet at a hospital and say, let me walk you through the system and make it work for you?
Exactly, yeah.
And I think I always did that, and I think that that's probably one of the reasons that I was selected in 1985 as the VA Nurse of the Year, because I really, really thought that my job was to help every client.
Did you know that that honor was coming to you, or was it a complete ambush?
It's a long process. I was interviewed initially by the person who filled out the paperwork for
mm-hmm.
me initially,
mm-hmm.
And it's a national competition,
yes.
if you will,
yes.
that, you know, it was a new honor that was being given for a nurse or a licensed practical nurse and a nursing assistant. So within the VA, they were then looking for candidates, and the supervisors of various hospitals then would write up their individuals, and then you'd go from the local competition to the regional competition and then to the national competition. And you don't know, I mean, I didn't see the write-up that went forward, and so it was quite a surprise, to say the least. And in San Francisco, where I received that, they had a huge local ceremony before I ever did go to Washington, D.C., where I was recognized. So it was a big deal.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Who was at the ceremony in D.C.?
Well, the Secretary for Veterans Affairs, before it was a cabinet position, but he was the administrator of it. And I had a brother and his wife and kids came, and I think my father was there also. And sometimes, you know, you don't recognize or know that something is a big deal until somebody shows up.
Right. I think I'm following you.
Yeah.
But yes, I believe just objectively that it was a big deal. I wonder if you can talk a little bit now about the circumstances that led to your being investigated by the military.
Well, let's see. This is not an easy topic to sort of summarize in a way.
And some of it is available in the book that you wrote.
Yes. But let me see if I can do it in a nutshell.
Sure. Okay.
I was married, had four sons, had always felt somewhat weird in my role as a wife.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, also been working sort of as a type A overachiever, if you will, going to school, working, having a mini farm, raising our own cattle, baking bread, making my own mayonnaise, you know, becoming self-sufficient out there on the farm, and was just extremely busy. I think looking for, I guess, contentment, not happiness, just contentment, and wondering why I was just doing as much as I could to be away from my husband. And the legitimate way of doing that was to be very involved professionally. And over the years, then doing well professionally, but finding that I just really was not that happy, and became ultimately became suicidal, and contemplated suicide, and that was very frightening, because it's frightening.
Yeah.
and especially if you don't know what's driving you there, because I had this seemingly utopian home and life, and got some help, and in the process of that, there was a little bit of exploration about whether or not my struggle with being intimate with my husband might mean that there was something else going on, and sort of approached as the possibility of sexuality being on a continuum, that at any particular point in time you could feel more attracted to someone of the opposite sex to not. And it was not something that I was really exploring, but that sort of came up to, you know, well, there's certainly something about me not wanting to be intimate with my husband, that I just needed some time and some distance. And over the course of 6-8 months, realized that I had to leave the marriage. And with a very ugly separation and then ultimately ugly divorce, ended up leaving my marriage in 1980. And over the years, you know, this was this was a time when I couldn't, as a somebody getting a divorce, I was not allowed to get a credit card. The credit card company would not honor me, even though I had two jobs. I had a long, been working for a long period of time, had paid most of the bills, and had to appeal it to be able to get my first credit card because everything had been in my joint name with my husband. And right now it sounds so bizarre.
I know.
But back then it was a very, very disconcerting because... Yeah. I thought I was an autonomous person, but ended up then over the next years finding out who I was. And it was during this time that I did very well as a nurse, both in the VA and in the military, and sort of found myself, if you will. Ended up, and it was during this time that. The reason I went to San Francisco is not because it is a gay haven, but rather it was because that's where the job was.
Sure, absolutely.
And a friend of mine whom I had worked with previously was down there, and she was able to, she said, well, if you want to go to San Francisco, we could live together, and it sort of gave me an excuse to leave town, if you will, because it had been so painful. And so I was able to then get back on my feet and realize over the years, in about 1985, realized that I really missed being close to the kids in the greater Seattle area and moved back up here.
Right.
And at some point, having reestablished really close connections with the kids, realized that, and by this time I was back in college, I was working on my doctorate, and realized that, if anything happened to me, there wasn't really anybody special in my life that would care. And it was one of these, I guess you'd say, revelations more than anything else. And because with that thought came the idea that, I just don't want to be in a relationship with a man.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stopped pursuing the thoughts at that point because I really didn't I really didn't know where that was going.
Mm-hmm.
And was pretty naive about stuff. And then in 1988, ended up meeting a woman on a date, it had been set up, but not by me, and I wasn't aware of it. And so I met Diane when I had taken my kids to visit my aunt down on the Oregon coast. And some mutual friends were also going up to the Oregon coast and had said to Diane, why don't you come up? It's a gorgeous place, and there's somebody we want you to meet. And if you've seen the movie Serving in Silence with Glenn Close and Judy Davis, it was all uphill from there. so Diane and I met, and over the months developed a relationship, and then on the, and that was in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1989, I had decided that I was doing fine. I was going to be finishing my doctorate eventually, but so I was working at school. But I really wanted to buy for the general's position that was now going to be available and open within the Guard in Washington, D.C., and to make myself competitive, I needed to go to the War College, and to go to the War College, you needed top secret clearance, and so I began the paperwork. And
had you ever had a clearance before?
Yeah, I had had clearances before, but I had never been interviewed, and I think that they had changed policies also of how often they did clearances and, you know, the different types of things they were doing. So I was, I guess, going to be up for an actual interview anyhow, but I just didn't know that. And then in the course of the interview, which took place in April of 89, there was some question having to do with homosexuality, and I don't recall the exact wording, but it was at this point that I recognized that my relationship with Diane was serious, and that must mean that that must mean something, and that I owned a label for the first time. As I said to the investigator, I am a lesbian. And the
that was the first time you had said that, really?
Yeah, it was the first time that I had put words to that.
Okay.
And sort of owned the label, if you will. It's a little bit like, I think, graduating from college, either as a nurse or a teacher or an engineer. You have the degree, but you certainly don't feel like a nurse or a teacher or an engineer. you have to build your way up to that, and that's what I think that's what it was happening with me. It was walking along the outside, and then realizing that ultimately, whether or not I was with Diane, that this was who I was. And when I said that, of course, the whole tenor of the investigation changed, and I spent the next hours being grilled, and what he was trying to draw out misconduct, but I was focusing on an emotional tie that I had that gave me that label, and over the next 4.5 hours, you know, it was just this grilling, and then ultimately he wanted me to sign a statement, and I said, well, you know, let me work on it a day or so, and I'll get back to you. And he said, well, no, let me write the statement, and you can just sign it. And I thought, you know, I'm really tired of all of this crap. And so he went away, typed up a letter that I ended up blacking out a whole bunch of stuff because of what his inference was different from what our conversation had been.
I see.
And then 6 months later, that letter was presented back to me from my command, who had been told through the chain that here was a lesbian in your command and you were going to have to discharge her. And so I was brought into my commander's office, and they said, you know, because of your statement, the military wants us to discharge you. And I said, you know, I really, I was humiliated, embarrassed, thinking that, you know, I was going to be making an honest statement and that would not be used against me.
Sure.
But they said that I could resign or retire. As I talked about it, you know, I said I did not want to leave. And they said, well, you know, if you want to stay in, as long as it doesn't become disruptive in the unit, then you have our support to do that. And then we'll just sort of see what transpires. And then over the next 2.5 years, they helped in stalling my discharge because I had to be proven of sound mind and body, and had to have physical exams and psychological evaluation and all of this stuff. And because I was in school and because this was the build-up for Iraq One, there were, and Madigan and at Fort Lewis, which is the medical facility, was so busy with other things that to try to get an appointment for me in any place was just stalled to the hilt. Because, you know, if you think about it, many of the people who were coming out ended up being discharged within 48 hours. and my discharge took 2.5 years because I was state chief nurse. I was
yes.
chief nurse of a hospital. We were getting ready to be mobilized and needing to get everything in order, and it would be extremely disruptive.
Yes, it turns out you were an important person.
Yeah, and even though we had state representatives, we had congressional representatives trying to get them to not discharge me,
mm-hmm.
the military was bound and determined that I was going to be booted out. And so, of course, we had to fight that.
Do you have any sense, did you have a sense at the time or subsequently, have you learned how high within the military the stalwart effort to discharge you went?
Well, I had heard from George Stephanopoulos mm-hmm. later and then from Clinton that they knew my case and that it had been discussed. But, you know, once something is public,
right.
then there isn't a way of losing the paperwork.
Right.
And we had heard that had taken place in other situations, and thought that it might just go away, but for some reason it didn't. And I had heard that the case had been discussed, and the more that came out, you know, the more that it was discussed, because it meant that the people were going to have to make decisions. And when candidate Clinton was running for as president,
yes.
In a public forum, I asked him if elected he would overturn the ban against gays serving in the military, because by that time I had been discharged in 1992,
mm-hmm.
and his campaign was in the latter part of 92, and
yes.
and so and he said that he would. So he and I had met him also going into that town meeting that was televised, and he recognized my name, and you know, so
he was already aware at that point.
Yes, yes, he was.
Uh-huh. And where was that town meeting?
That particular one was in Seattle, Washington.
How had you come to meet him before the broadcast?
Well, I think sometimes when there's a notorious person around, the television station tries to bring mm-hmm. Challenging guests to be part of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been contacted to come and to be part of the audience. And you had to give your social security number and everything else in advance. So,
mm-hmm.
So I was planted there. Nobody told me what to say or that I would even be asked. But I think it was probably very self-evident that this was a question that was hot in the minds of a lot of people.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the 2.5 years where you were effectively battling the discharge? Who besides Diane was your closest confidant and best source of aid?
Well, when I knew that I was going to be discharged, you know, the first thing after my coming out event
mm-hmm.
to the investigator was this thinking that, you know, I wonder if I'm in trouble.
Yes.
And so I called the ACLU to see if there might be some assistance or what I want to do, what I should do, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, they said, well, until something has actually happened, they're not going to be able to, you know, give me any advice. And so 6 months later, when something did happen, the Perry Watkin case had just been settled, and the ACLU had been involved in his case.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was some erroneous information given to me when I called back to the ACLU and said, you know, they're going to discharge me, I need help, and the volunteer had said, well, you know, we've already done this case, and so we're not interested. And
by that they meant we've already done a test case in this area of the law?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Sure.
And so we're not going to be available to help out. And I was pretty devastated because I realized that I wasn't going to be able to take the military on alone and needed some help. And then through various serendipitous things mm-hmm. that happened, ended up being connected with somebody who knew of Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, and which is a huge legal team that takes on precedent-setting cases around the country. And so they reviewed my case and everything that was going on and decided to take on the case, which was just a huge, huge lifting of a burden for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had also been in contact with the Military Law Task Force out of San Diego, which had been actually the first people to say nothing.
Right.
Don't answer any questions and refer them to us. And so first the Military Law Task Force, then Lambda Legal Defense, and then ultimately the Northwest Women's Law Center, where I had attorneys from both Lambda and from the Northwest Women's Law Center that became my legal team. And Mary Newcomb, particularly from Lambda, became my guiding guardian angel throughout the next several years. They were first involved in the military case, and then I had a military attorney also who worked very closely with them. And so it took, my hearing was like a two-day hearing, but, you know, they had worked long and hard on the case. And then on the 14th and 15th of July of 1991, which was ironically, you know, 20 years to the date of when I had enlisted in the military. And that's when the hearing took place, and I was told that, you know, Margaret, you are a great American, and that said, because of the policy the way it is, that we have to recommend your discharge from the military, and if the policy ever changes, that your case be reconsidered. And, of course, it was devastating. Emotionally, you know, my belief system in terms of taking care of your own, all of what I had mm-hmm. spent 25 years believing in was just pulled out from underneath me. There was a automatic review process that took an additional year, but during that time, the legal teams were working on what they were going to do in terms of filing a federal lawsuit. And so in June of 1992, I was formally discharged and turned in my papers and everything. And actually, the last thing I turned in was a manual that I had prepared for that was could be used as a prototype for setting up any new medical facility. So I turned in this 400-page document along with my ID card, sort of a farewell gift, if you will, to the military. And then ironically began a discharge from the military, but a public life that I had just never, ever imagined would
right.
take place.
I just want to clarify that the discharge, what was the status?
Well, it was, I was stripped of all rank and privilege that they had withdrawn my, what they say, they withdraw your federal recognition as a military officer, and so essentially said that I was never in the military. And at the time, since I was not yet 60, it looked as though I might also lose my pension.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And when I later talked with Senator Nunn about that, he had said that that had never been the intent of the policy. But, you know, at the time, you know, you're stripped of everything, and I envision it a little bit like some of the court martials you see on television, where they rip off your
right.
rank and push you out the fort door and or gates, and then close the gate behind you as though you had never been in the military. And it certainly, you know, felt that way. I came home and put all of my uniforms. I couldn't even look at them, and I just took everything that I had that belonged to the military or recollection. I hid them as far away in my closet as I could,
mm-hmm.
so I wouldn't have to look at it because
yeah.
of the pain. But you know, again, the kid said, "Well, you know, you don't want to burn your uniforms because that would." If there was ever a question, then you would be considered absent without leave. I mean, you know, I just...
Good for them.
Yeah,
good for them.
I had just been fired. And,
right.
You know, so things change drastically in terms of being a very private person now to being publicly acknowledged for challenging the military. And was welcomed into a gay community that I did not have a clue existed.
Pretty amazing, huh?
It was absolutely. I mean, this was in June of 92.
Mm-hmm.
In July of 92, they had Gay Pride in Seattle, and I was invited as a keynote speaker. And there were 20,000 people there. My gosh, I came on stage and got a standing ovation, and I thought, my gosh, where have I been?
Who are these people?
Yeah, it was just absolutely the most astounding experience I think I had ever had, maybe except for, you know, being delivered into this world.
Mm. That's an interesting analogy. Can you talk about the decision to write your autobiography?
Well, the reason for writing a book is so that it's your spin, not
mm-hmm.
somebody else.
Sure.
Very shortly after I became notorious, a fellow from New York contacted me. I'd had a number of people who wanted to represent me, if you will.
I'm sure.
And, again, not realizing what... the opportunities were to talk about gays in the military beyond myself and how we were looking to change the world, if you will. And so this fellow called and said, he asked how I was doing. I mean, he'd introduced himself, of course, but then he was the only one who ever asked how I really was doing and feeling. About being hurt, about the notoriety, about, you know, any sense of where all of the stuff was going. And I think because of that conversation, he ended up becoming my agent. And he would help book me to speak at various universities around the country or events and things like that. And at the same time, there were a lot of newspaper and magazine articles being written, and he suggested that so that I could tell my story rather than for somebody else to do it, that it would probably be a good idea to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, why would anybody read this book? Because my life is... I mean, it was just my life. It wasn't
sure.
like it was a big thing. But then as I began thinking about it, it was, what are some of the issues? It's about the struggle to to recognize the role of women in society. It's being a professional and learning how to be autonomous. It's about women's struggle in a society that was so patriarchal that you couldn't have a job outside of the home without being considered weird.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up being multi-functional, I guess, if you will, because it was then the struggle in these various roles of serving as a nurse in Vietnam and what it really was like, and then coming to realize that I was a lesbian and that struggle and dealing with the kids and that. So it began to seem like it was more than just the gays in the military. And so I began writing it, and by the time I'd done several hundred pages and George had read it and we peddled it to a publisher, the question was, you know, this sounds a little bit more like a research paper than it does somebody's autobiography. Can you liven it up?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, for one thing, I'm Norwegian, and that's sort of delimiting.
Contradiction, yes. Okay.
Yeah, and I was just finishing my, I had just finished my PhD, which was equally dry, and I said, probably not, but I do know of a writer that I'd worked with previously, and so I asked Chris Fisher if she would work with me on livening the book so that it would, you know, be a little more like an autobiography. And so she and I worked together for 18 months, and I think she captured my voice. And the book ends before the resolution to the case and that sort of thing. So I am currently, after the election, planning on sort of revitalizing that and going through it a bit and tweaking areas that I now think I can tweak
Good.
A little better.
Good. Look forward to that very, very much. at what point did the property get purchased for making of the film?
The book draft had been finished, and I had gotten some early queries about making a movie, but not from people that really had connections,
mm-hmm.
and then ended up getting a phone call from Barwood Studios, and I didn't have a clue, you know, what's Barwood?
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, we're calling on behalf of Barbara Streisand. And it was, oh, I know that name.
Sure.
She played in Yentl.
Exactly.
But
among other things.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, my world was not involved in film or music very much. And
sure.
So, yeah, I recognized the name and had respect for the work that she had done. And so I said that I would need to contact my attorney. I called Mary, who said, well, you know, Greta, you really cannot go to talk with Barbara Streisand without your attorney. And so
mm-hmm.
Mary and I went and discussed it with Barbara and Sis Corman and Craig, Zayden and Neil Marin, who are all ended up being co-producers.
Now, did you meet with Barbara personally?
Yeah.
Where
yes.
was that meeting?
At her house.
In California?
In Carrollwood Road when she had a house there mm-hmm. in Hollywood. And, you know, I can play it to the hilt. You know, we drove up and the gate was locked and you push the button and somebody asks who it is and Mary said, you know, Greta Cammermeyer and Mary Newcomb to meet with Barbara Streisand, so the gate opens, like, and we drive through, and there's this bungalow hidden under trees that, and things that I thought needed to be cut down so that's more sun.
Good for you.
You know, I didn't tell her that specifically.
Right,
but
maybe not on the first meeting, maybe a little later.
So we had the meeting in her living room, and in big overstuffed couches that you sank down too far.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being 6 feet tall,
yes. Orthopedically
was
difficult.
But they had wonderful, wonderful fruit hors d'oeuvres, and you know, you could see that, and NBC was there also, and you could see that everybody was very, I don't know if you'd use the word cautious, but certainly in awe,
mm-hmm.
Or respectfully distant, and waiting for Barbara to not only come in, but then to set the stage of what the conversation should be afterwards. And I think the key thing for me after she said, well, wouldn't you like to have your life story told on television to 25 million people, I said, no, not particularly.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the answer to that is.
It's like, why would I want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And she, but when she said, I consider this the most important social issue of the decade, that everyone in America, in their homes, can see what the struggle and lives of gay and lesbian people are. Then it took on a different meaning altogether, because then it was not about me.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the lives and struggles of gays and lesbians, even though we were the conduit, if you will. And so then we agreed to do that, and then had an attorney working with us,
mm-hmm.
because we were still in a legal situation, and we didn't want Hollywood to go crazy, or that the whole tenor and demeanor be inappropriate for what for the whole filming. And it turns out that two of the producers were also gay.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, it was, I mean, Barbara has a gay son. And for the gay producers, it was an opportunity to probably for the first time portray gays and lesbians in a positive light.
Yes, I mean, it's certainly a landmark film and recognized that way already. And, you know, as the years go by, we'll I think, more keenly be seen In that light. It's very interesting that that Barbara Streisand put that kind of broader social spin on it. What was your impression of her? I mean, did you take her as a very thoughtful person?
Yeah, she was very intense, and
yes.
you could, well, intense. I mean, she was not distant, but not somebody that you were going to feel like you were going to be best buddies with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's the aura that is created by the people around her also.
Mm-hmm.
It was a social distance. And me as a stranger,
sure.
I don't know where that social distance came from with regard to everyone else, or whether it was that they had put her on such a pedestal that you know, everybody sort of sits at the feet of.
Right. A very strange place for her to be in as well, I'm sure. Just a strange life to live, really.
Well, except she had also created it.
And you can see that being necessary to some extent.
Yeah, I think in her struggles in various arenas,
mm-hmm.
I think Sis Corman is probably one of her longest and dearest or oldest and dearest friends,
mm-hmm.
One of the executive producers. She's also the one that does all of the casting.
How do you spell her last name?
Corman.
Uh-huh.
And so they have a long history, but, you know, I don't know what any of the relationships
are
with Barbara, but lending her name to the film, of course, was a huge factor in its success. And the fact that Glenn Close then was willing to take on a challenging role to create this persona. Hey, that's with me.
How much time did you spend with Glenn Close?
Well, she and I had talked a couple of times, and then Diane and I ended up going up to the set at the time that the filming took place.
Which was happening where?
That was in Vancouver, okay. British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
We had also sent them a draft of the book, mm-hmm. so that the playwright, Alison Cross, who got an Emmy for the script, ended up having that draft so that she could build the characters. And so I think the film, even though it hadn't been marketed that way, was certainly taken from the book and created the scenario as it did. But your question was?
I was asking whether you were able to spend much time with Glenn Close.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So when the filming took place, I spent about 11 days on the set.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was, I felt confident by this time that they were going to do a good... I had seen the draft, and Diane and I one night had... when right after the draft came in, we came through and we rewrote the whole text, because it was Diane and I didn't speak to one another that way,
mm-hmm.
and so we were recreating it in our own words. And needless to say, they ignored that.
But you gave it a try.
We did, and then we realized, oh, it's not about us.
Right.
And then we so I was up there, and my concern was more that she portray the military officer correctly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So making sure that she saluted properly, that she was wearing the uniform properly, that when she was in a military setting up there, that all of what she did was what I would have done. And I think they appreciated that. Because, the one way to lose credibility in doing a film is somehow to have a sloppy salute, or that
sure.
it's not done correctly, or that you're not walking on the proper side of a subordinate or superior officer. I mean, all of the things that you might not even think about that are of absolute importance in terms of military protocol. And then there were also occasions where they were getting ready to shoot a particular scene, and Glenn would come and say, "Now, I don't quite get this particular scene. Why don't you fill me in on what happened or how you were feeling?" And
mm-hmm.
then I would tell her what it had been like, and then she would go right in front of the camera as though she had been walking in my shoes at the actual event. And so as we were looking at the reruns every day, it was really eerie. And occasionally I had to walk away because I could not stand to see it again, if you will,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because it was so painful the first time. And then to relive it again on television was... while it was being filmed,
right.
it was painful.
How did Glenn Close strike you?
Was she a very thoughtful
person?
Yeah, like your a next door neighbor that you really like.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
She could not be warmer, more genuine, more open, more just a real decent human being. If I can give
sure.
The first day we went up on the set, we drove up to where they were shooting. Glenn saw us coming, realized who we were, and as soon as the particular sequence had been shot, she came over to me and introduced herself and said hello, and she said, you know, my dad would like to talk with you. And I thought, what in the world? You know, I don't have a clue what's going on. So right. she calls her father, who is a highly regarded surgeon who worked as medical officer for one of the African kings. It sounds something out of Jurassic Park or something.
Right.
And so her dad and I had this long, wonderful conversation. But, I mean, it was like she just sort of made some assumptions that, you know, we were good buddies. And,
right.
And so, it was that sort of real genuineness that she had then. And when I ran for Congress some years later, she came to a couple of events, which, of course, made it a big deal.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In support of my candidacy.
You said earlier that in transitioning to becoming a public figure, a very well-known public figure and an activist for veterans' rights issues and gay rights generally, that all of that isn't really about you. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Well, I think if your ego goes along with any of this stuff, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
My notoriety occurred because there was something about what the government was doing that resonated as being unfair. And it was unfair to me, but what I think that and hope to represent is the hundreds and thousands of other gay and lesbian service members who have served and who don't have a voice and have not had the exposure or the opportunity to talk about what the military did to them, if you will, just because of their sexual orientation. And so I think I have felt that the media created me as a name that people would recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And that as long as somebody is still remembering that, I have an opportunity to talk about the continuous plight of gays and lesbians serving in the military. Because I'm a dead case, an old case. a cold case,
yeah.
I guess is what it is on television. But the story of gays being discharged is still a continuous case. And until that law changes, I will continue to speak at every opportunity. And that doesn't have anything to do with me, because I did get reinstated. I did win my lawsuit after, finally things closed off totally after 10 years and through the extraordinary work of my attorneys. But in its place is the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law, which we continue to lose. In 1993, we were losing 2 to 3 people per day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To the law, and not because of misconduct, but because of witch hunts and because of just them not being able to live under that sort of horrible condition of never knowing whether or not you're going to be beaten up, killed, or discharged from the military. So it's not about me, but it is about our collective cause of trying to change that law.
Were you disappointed with President Clinton when he failed to eliminate the provision from both military regs and the law?
I was devastated. I was in Washington, D.C., getting ready to celebrate with
yes.
everyone his election, and I was actually at a fundraising event and a major event for David Mixner,
mm-hmm.
Who had been Clinton's roommate in college, also a gay activist who had worked very hard for Clinton's reelection. And so we were all thanking David for his work. And in the midst of that event, Gary Studs, a congressional representative from Massachusetts, one of two gay legislators, came over and said, Greta, the president will not be signing an executive order. And, you know, tears just welled up because we had so counted on him. And he said that if he had signed that executive order, both in the House and in the Senate, there were plans to introduce a bill that would overturn the executive order and would ban gays and lesbians from serving altogether. And in its place, that the president would institute a moratorium, 6-month moratorium, where there would be discussions on how to implement a policy where gays could serve in the military. And so there was this huge, tragic disappointment. And because, among other things, there were many gays who were coming out on national television because they believed that they were going to be safe. And then there was this 6-month period of where there was a lobbying effort by many of us, and the Senate hearings where I was a part of those hearings, and talking to the congressional or at the Senate, mm-hmm. and realizing that it was all a setup. Because
right.
the decisions had already been made, and regardless of what we said, it wasn't going to make any difference, which was extremely disappointing in terms of understanding or not understanding what lobbying and Congress and jockeying for position is all about.
Greta, is that when you spoke with Senator Sam Nunn?
Mm-hmm.
Did you speak with him privately, or did he convey the... what he understood or what he thought the intent of discharging you was? Did he convey that publicly?
That was with his legislative assistant.
Okay.
It was conveyed through him when I spoke with him. I think his last name was Adams.
Mm-hmm.
That he that had never been their intent. And that they would look into that. But then in the course of time, you know, I won the lawsuit anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it makes for good copy.
Yeah. At what at what point did the lawsuit decision come to you, and in what court was it decided?
Well, we went into federal district court in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of various appeals at various levels, so it went up to the Ninth Circuit a number of times also. And then in July of 1994, I was contacted first by the Northwest Women's Law Center to say that we had won our lawsuit and that we were going to have a press conference. And so of course, was ecstatic, and the newspaper picture showed me with my two Northwest Women's cooperating attorneys just
mm-hmm.
beaming because we had won. And, of course, it was, you know, a big deal.
Sure.
The Justice Department had lost. Really good.
What was the judgment, actually, if you can capsulize it?
That my discharge had been unconstitutional.
On what grounds?
That I had been denied equal protection.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's, as a present, my two attorneys framed the decision. And it's, you know, Margaret Kammermeier, plaintiff, versus Les Aspin, Secretary of Defense et al. Defendants. You know, it's there now. And so I was sent back on active duty. I got a call from the adjutant general, who was the commanding officer in the state, and said, Colonel Kammermeyer, you have you were never discharged. And next weekend is a drill weekend, and we expect you to report. And that was it.
And how was it for you going back to service? Can you describe that feeling?
Yeah, it was eerie. I mean, the press, of course, wanted to be part of it all, and I said that, you know, I would be driving through the gate at such and such a time, and when I left on Sunday evening, I would stop and meet with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove on to post. You know, it was a time when, because of all of the notoriety, it was very humiliating that anybody should even know that I was gay. It was nobody's business, and I just wanted to do my job.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
And so you feel naked, essentially, as though you're running around the street and everybody knows who you are.
And this is the thing they now know about you.
Yes.
The only thing they need. Most cases.
Yeah, I mean, at least I was in uniform so that they could see my biography.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it was this very personal, intrusive, not socially acceptable label that at that time particularly, because this was 1994, it was only 10 years ago, but the perhaps it was my own homophobia that made me feel that very, very exposed and vulnerable. And so I went in. I was in uniform. I went in and was welcomed back to the unit. And, you know, they applauded and seemed very pleased to see me. My book had just come out,
mm-hmm.
or was just coming out, and they wanted to get my signatures on it and things like that, which was also weird.
Like you're a rock star now or something.
Yeah, but, you know, obviously the people who were asking for it, by this time my gaydar was not misfunctioning.
Right.
And so it was like, hey, you know, we ought to just cool this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll sign it in the parking
right.
lot, or
right.
you know, behind the alley or something
right,
like.
It could be dangerous for
yeah,
for
yeah, and so I was certainly well received back at the unit, but I felt that, you know, there were so many things that had changed for me also in no longer trusting.
Yeah.
No longer feeling that blind faith in the greater good in the military. And so I was somewhat disenchanted. And the person that had replaced me as chief nurse had done a real good job. And when I came back in, they said that I should go back and resume my previous position. Well, I didn't want to do that. I thought that it was inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I had lost 2 years of continuity, and he had done, you know, I had mentored him
mm-hmm.
to do the job. He had done a good job. And then for me to come back and blindside them just because I won, it struck me as being really unfair. And so at first he and I discussed things of what I could do sort of on the periphery and him to maintain his position. And then I ultimately asked for a reassignment, which was denied, and I think part of that was because of the fear of a lawsuit or something else. And so after a year of doing additional assignments but not really finding any meat, I went into an inactive status, which meant that I didn't have to report to drill and things like that, but if there was a call-up, that I could be called up, and
mm-hmm.
that I had some options about about going back more actively. And I think probably the most interesting thing that happened throughout the time of my reinstatement was I received a phone call from personnel and said, Colonel, you meet all of the requirements for a general's position that is now vacant and would like to submit your packet. And I thought, what an irony.
Absolutely.
And I started to laugh. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you know who you're talking to? And he said, oh, yes, ma'am. And I thought, you know, 4 years, 3 years previously, I would have jumped at that opportunity, and I said, I'd prefer that you not submit my packet.
What, if you can just explicate what made you make that decision?
Well, I think, as I said previously, that I had become disenchanted, that the role of being gay in the military, even though I was now covered under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so nobody was supposed to know except for the movie and the book.
Right. And a few little inconvenient things like that.
Yeah, that this was not where my heart was. That I think that there would always be that tension within me thinking that, you know, either I'm not going to get a position because of being gay, or that why subject everybody to the struggle of trying to figure out whether or not this was going to be a detraction and stuff. So I decided not to go through it, and that I would finish up my time and retire.
When did you retire?
I was mandatorily retired after 31 years in 1997.
Was that difficult for you, or was it a relief in some way?
No, well, it was a surprise.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because I hadn't realized that there was a mandatory retirement for officers after 30 years. And so I didn't have my parade.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it was really anticlimactic in a way.
I see.
But in lieu of that, ended up having a big retirement party here at home.
I bet.
Yeah.
When did you decide to make a run for public office?
Well, Diane and I had built this home up on an island. I retired from both my civilian job and the military job, mm-hmm. and spent a year finishing up things here and didn't have anything to do. And a fellow here on the island said, Greta, you're not doing anything. Why don't you run for Congress? And with deep thought, I said, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, that was the conversation.
Wow.
Because I had not a clue of what I was getting myself into. But it was probably the most eye-opening experience that anybody could possibly have.
What year did you run, Greta?
It was for the 98 election.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started in, I think it was the fall of 97. And I thought, hey, you know, I've got military experience, I'm a nurse, and I've got time, and I'm smart.
Sure.
And I thought those were probably good credentials to have when you're running for Congress.
Now, did you get through the primary?
Yeah, I won in the primary 2-1 against my opponent.
Mm-hmm.
I was running against a 40-year veteran of politics and an incumbent who was running for his last term for Congress. So it was a little bit of a setup.
Yes.
But I didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't get any support from Emily's List. I didn't have support from the Democratic Party. And so it was an uphill battle. But I only lost by about 5 percentage points.
Wow.
With all of that. And so it wasn't bad, all things considered, but it was a great experience, and I'm now chair of the Democratic Party out here, which is sort of ironic.
Yes, again, another irony.
Yeah, but now it's I think people realize that I'm a good organizer, and we have, you know, markedly increased the number of people that are involved and vote. And when I was telling people that Diane and I had gotten married on the 19th of March, you know, everybody was celebrating with us. And so it's this in-your-face, and it's a little bit scary at first for everybody, and then after that it's like old news, you know, let's move on with it. And I think that's been the exciting thing for
sure.
all of us, is to be part of always needing to take on the challenge. And I don't know if I've mentioned it previously, but what I use as a mantra, if you, mm-hmm. you will, is that if you're in a place where you're uncomfortable, it's where you ought to be.
Good.
Because any place else,
yeah.
you're among friends and family, and you're not going to change anything.
Right. You're in resting mode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if you're uncomfortable, that's like, ah. And Diane, who has never considered herself an activist, just now married to one, she goes to the Episcopalian Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so the week after we were married, she stood up in front of the whole congregation because they asked, you know, if there was something special that went on in your life. And so she stood up and said, you know, Greta and I got married on the 19th, and people applauded.
Really?
And smiled, and she still is getting congratulations, and it's like she would never, I mean, not only would she never have done it previously,
mm-hmm.
but the homophobia would have, you know, gotten
oh,
in
yeah.
the way, but she would could never have imagined the positive response. There was not a scowl or a face of rejection in the crowd.
Can you, first of all, where did you receive a license?
We eloped and went to Portland.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And
is Portland at this point, today's the 5th of April, are they still issuing licenses?
As far as I know, they are.
Okay.
There are some counties in Portland, I mean in Oregon, that are not, but they've put both gay and straight marriages on hold.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
There was a decision by the Attorney General in Oregon, evidently suggesting that he was not at all convinced that the laws that existed in Oregon was constitutional,
mm-hmm.
and therefore to prevent lawsuits, that they would not prevent the signing or the issuance of marriage licenses.
Can you talk about the parallels, if you see any, between allowing gays to serve unharassed in the military and the civil rights issues around same-sex marriage and unions?
Well, I think that as society changes and recognizes that the gays and lesbians in society are just like everybody else in society, that the military also is going to have to adapt. The unfortunate thing is that because it's a law, it needs to be changed through Congress,
mm-hmm.
and that may act as a drawback because many are going to be reluctant to make a vote in support of civil rights unless it can be couched in terms of a social need or a military need, because we can't lose more good trained service members.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, to me, they're all the mini steps that we continue to need to take for full equality and our civil as well as our human rights. And it may be that we get marriage rights before the military changes,
mm-hmm.
but I think that if they're going to continue to have a volunteer military, they're going to have to shape up, because the youth of today could care less. It's the old guard and the radicals on one side or the other that are the ones that are entrenched in this, mixing I think erroneously, civil versus religious components of just the diversity in society and in the world.
Can you give a sense of how active you are now in speaking, in politics? How much traveling do you do on behalf of the cases and the causes that we've been speaking about?
There are cyclic interest in gays in the military, and I am on the honorary board with the Service Members Legal Defense Network and affiliated superficially with the Center for the Study of Sexual Minorities in the Military.
Mm-hmm.
And so my actual speaking and involvement depends on, you know, what's the hot issue at the time. And sometimes I'm asked to participate, and I don't consider myself the best person any longer.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of really fine flag officers, generals and admirals, who are now, you know, in the forefront of,
yes.
And they outrank me. So I may have the history, but they have credibility by rank, and it's a little bit like it's not about me.
Sure.
That my story, interesting, been there, done that. but now it's the people who are struggling with the don't ask, don't tell law, and. If you're not relevant, you're history. But at the same time, it's trying to get the people that can make the difference to get the name recognition so that they're out there talking. So there's a part of me that says, oh, I'm going to be forgotten. The other part says, oh, I'm going to be forgotten.
I hear you, yeah.
So it's a curious thing. It's always flattering when someone says, I remember when.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, it's nice. What can I do now to sort of re-energize that people will remember for more than just the old stuff,
sure.
but that there's something new. So it, you know, on a personal note, there's the mature part of me that says, you know, time to move on, do something different. The child in me says, hey, I'm still here.
Well, on that note, in terms of the contemporary conflict that the U.S. military is committed to, do you draw any comparisons between that and the war that took you overseas to Vietnam?
I think the main similarity is the public displeasure. And curiously, nowadays it's almost by political party that one is using patriotism and the soldiers as a reason for supporting a conflict that, if you look at it, what the real reasons were for going and how the American people were duped, it's very similar to Vietnam.
Now, by duped, can you say what you mean?
Well, the Bay of Tonkin being the reason that we allegedly committed forces in Vietnam, even though we had been building up there for quite some time, on the one hand, versus weapons of mass destruction and imminent threat to America as being a reason to go into Iraq, a sovereign country that had done nothing other than offend the president or the president's father. And that's not to say that this wasn't a bad guy, but, you know, why did we not do anything in Rwanda? Why did we not do anything against the genocide that was taking place elsewhere in the world? And then suddenly, out of just the willy-nilly of a president that has said in his mind that we're going to go into this country and they're just going to be so happy to see us, I think it's really scary. But in terms of Vietnam and the comparison between the two, I think it's mostly the way that the American people were duped.
Mm-hmm. Greta, I want to thank you for your time this morning and for participating in the Oral History Project.
My pleasure.